I'm not going to read a paper. I actually have a book that's done on aesthetics. And I was trying to think about the best way to come at this, and I decided, since I'm supposed to talk for about 35 or 40 minutes and then open it up to questions, that I wouldn't do a big kind of historical thing on nihilism, talking about Nietzsche, although I'm happy to talk about Nietzsche in the question period. I want to come at this in a way that I think works for, and I'm going to show some clips at the end, works for this particular topic, and it'll be much more focused than that very grandiose title that you were invited to come hear about tonight. I want to talk a little bit about the papal encyclical Laudato Si and what Francis has to say about the crisis of modernity. That'll be the first section briefly. The second section, which will also be fairly brief, will be about the sources of the modern crisis. And the third section is going to be about my claim that what the encyclical is calling for and what I would certainly call for as a response to this crisis and its sources is a twofold recovery. One is a recovery of the classical Catholic account of creation, and the second would be a recovery of an understanding of a sort of classical understanding of the artist as providing a kind of sacramental vision of nature. And that's where I will turn at the end to a couple short clips from the film Tree of Life as an example of the kind of thing that I think we need. So, in the Pope's encyclical, Laudato Si, which is known mainly for its reflection on ecology, its concerns about climate change, and its very concrete recommendations about how we might begin to respond to that environmental crisis. But very early on and throughout, the Pope also insists that that ecological threats are but one symptom of a much broader crisis. And he says this: if the present ecological crisis is one small sign of the ethical, cultural, and spiritual crisis of modernity, we cannot presume to heal our relationship with nature and the environment without healing all fundamental human relationships. He talks about the crisis, and here in this, he's following very closely his two immediate papal predecessors, John Paul II and Benedict XVI. He talks about the crisis as arising from an excessive anthropomorphism. That phrase comes up a number of times in the document. And interestingly, he quotes, and I just want to read one other passage. Francis says, this is due to the excessive anthropocentrism. Another way to put that is a kind of radical notion of human autonomy that is constrained by nothing outside the individual will. And he says, we have forgotten that, Francis writing in section 6, man is not only a freedom which he creates for himself. Man does not create himself. He is spirit and will, but also nature. And then he quotes Benedict. Creation is harmed where we ourselves have the final word, where everything is simply our property, and we use it for ourselves alone. The misuse of creation begins when we no longer recognize anything higher than ourselves, when we see nothing else but ourselves. So when we look at, there's a great, I think, New Yorker cartoon from a few years ago where it's a guy sitting in a chair watching TV, and the image on the TV is of a man sitting in a chair watching TV, right? Where we look out and see only ourselves reflected back at us, and where there's nothing outside of our choice. Got a great quote about nihilism, and I take it that what Benedict and Francis are describing is something that's nihilistic or tending toward nihilism. James Hunter, a sociologist at the University of Virginia, defines nihilism as unfettered will legitimated by the ideology of choice, so that there's nothing outside the individual will in light of which we can judge whether choices are better or worse, more true or more false, good or evil. This is the excessive anthropocentrism that that Francis is concerned about, where we see in the world only the values that we have already placed there. So that there are, with respect to technology and with respect to the environment, there is nothing in nature that dictates limits to us, and there is nothing beyond our own will that could dictate limits. Francis is very concerned about the fact that once we enter into the realm of pure technology, and he's not a Luddite, but he's very concerned about what he calls the ironclad logic of technological progress that seems self-perpetuating and seems to allow for no conversation about limits, about ends, about proper use of means. This is very much a problem for him that, in a sense, the ecological crisis, which he's very authentically concerned about, is a symptom of something that pervades modernity and that he is more deeply concerned about than he is merely about the problem of the environment. Now, one of the things we have to note here as well is that Francis is also worried about what he calls a kind of schizophrenia in our approach to nature. So that we move back and forth between an excessive anthropocentrism and what he calls on the other side biocentrism, which admits, it sort of engulfs the human within nature and sees the human as something that's only in nature a source of evil. Right? So historically, for Francis, these roots go back. There are some things that don't match up here quite right, but they go back, in a sense, to the battle between Enlightenment rationalism and progressivism on the one hand, and the kind of 19th century romantic reaction against that, right? Wordsworth saying, we murder to dissect, right? This sense in romantic poetry that we've lost this natural, harmonious relationship with nature, and that our control over nature threatens alienation from nature, from one another, and from ourselves. This is the crisis as Francis sees it, and the common cure for the excessive anthropocentrism, what he calls biocentrism, is equally problematic because it doesn't allow for a proper place in nature for the human person. It's also somewhat contradictory because it wants to diminish the role of human persons in nature, but it's constantly blaming human persons for being the source of evil in nature. This is a bit crude, but you do find this in the last 20 to 30 years in the environmental movement itself. You find a number of people saying, this is a problem. This kind of romantic biocentrism is a problem. And what we need is some better understanding of the proper place of human persons in the whole. So Francis says repeatedly, we can't have an adequate ecology without an adequate anthropology. And I would add to that that I think Francis is also saying that we need some sort of cosmology. That doesn't mean that we worked out all the big questions about the Big Bang and expanding universe and all of that, but we need to be thinking about not just who we are as human persons and anthropology, but also what is our place in the whole. And here, I will argue toward the end that this is one of the areas in which art can play a crucial role. So, that's the first part. What are the sources of this? I've already said, given you some idea of what Francis thinks are the sources of these two views, right? One is a kind of, in its extreme form, you can pull passages out of Descartes and Bacon, right, where the goal of the new method, in each case, there are different methods, but the goal of the new method, as Descartes says at one point, is to render us masters and possessors of nature. Right? And nature is viewed as a kind of raw material that can be mapped out mathematically, and we can manipulate it. Bacon is a different approach, but for a similar end. In fact, Bacon's promise in the New Organon, right, is that he can overcome the effects of the fall. He can return us through his method to the state of Eden, where we have a natural connection with nature, where we see it more clearly and can manipulate it more thoroughly. Interestingly, there's a chapter in in Francis's encyclical called The Human Roots of the Crisis. That title calls to mind a famous article by Lynn White in the 60s on the historical roots of the ecological crisis, which White traces to Christianity. Right? With Christianity, White claims, there is for the first time a divine sanction on the human control of lordship over nature. Interestingly, also, White treats the 13th century Francis, St. Francis of Assisi, as a kind of eccentric, unorthodox exception to this general Christian approach to nature. I wonder, my colleague Alan Jacobs was the first one who pointed this out to me, my colleague at Baylor, I wonder whether Francis is directly, in some sense, responding to White by these two titles being almost the same. Of course, what Francis is offering is quite a different genealogy, right? And his 13th century St. Francis of Assisi is both the model of Catholic orthodoxy and the model for how we ought to think about the environment. And Francis does not treat his predecessor Francis as an exception, but more like the paradigm. It's also very interesting, just in passing about the document itself, that the way in which Pope Francis puts together things in the tradition that aren't typically put together. You might know, if you're a Chesterton reader, this famous chapter in his book on Thomas Aquinas, where he talks about the two friars. And he does something most people who've written on Aquinas have never done. He puts Aquinas with Francis, with St. Francis. These are two of a kind. And it's because he sees in St. Francis of Assisi's approach to nature, his poetic approach to nature, a kind of new openness to the natural world and to a sacramental vision. Where is this in Aquinas? Well, for Chesterton, it's in Aquinas' affirmation of Aristotle's study of nature. Right? He puts the two together. In 86 and 87, in the encyclical, Francis quotes Thomas at length in 86 about what creation is. And he quotes from the commentary on the physics of all things as if to emphasize Aquinas' serious commitment to natural philosophy, to the study of science. In 87, you get the longest quote in the entire encyclical from St. Francis of Assisi's Canticle. It's as if juxtaposing these two, he's saying, we need both of these. We need a rigorous approach to nature through science that is conducted in the way that Aquinas set an example in the 13th century, but we also need a poetic, sacramental expression of nature as well that Francis of Assisi offers. White's claim about Christianity does mirror some of the talk in people like Nietzsche who want to label Christianity as the source of nihilism. Right? White's claiming, well, God giving human persons sanctions over the natural world leads to a kind of evacuation of meaning in the natural world. Except what? What we put there through our will. Nietzsche thinks that one of the ways in which Christianity leads to nihilism is it disvalues this world for the sake of another world. Right? It evacuates this world of meaning because everything's only for the sake of another world. So there's a kind of connection there in White's view and in Nietzsche's view about the historical roots of nihilism. I think, though, that, and I've already indicated this by the quotes about creation from Aquinas and the poetry of Francis of Assisi, that what Francis wants to do is to recover a proper understanding of creation. At one point, he says that nature is typically imagined as a system that we can understand and manipulate. Now, so far as I can tell in the document, Francis does not deny that that is a legitimate way to approach nature, that we can understand it as a system and manipulate it to certain ends. What he wants to do with that way of approaching nature, I think, is to say, first is to say, it is only one of the ways of understanding nature. And it needs to be subordinate, as he goes on in the passage that I'm quoting from to say that the primary thing is to understand nature as a gift and to understand it as an interrelated set of parts of a whole that needs to be appreciated in awe, in wonder, and in gratitude. So he develops in the encyclical what I would call a set of ecological virtues, right? Of awe, wonder, gratitude. Right? These, for Francis, are the key virtues that enable us to respond to nature and to one another in the right way. Not denying that that we should rejecting technology or saying that we can't properly understand it in a scientific way, but that's got to be rooted in a prior encounter with nature that sees nature as a gift and responds with awe, wonder, and gratitude. By the way, if you were to go back and sort of try and tease out this Enlightenment domination of nature side, there's a really interesting passage at the very beginning of Descartes' work on the Passions of the Soul, where the first passion that he talks about is wonder. And wonder is a vice in that treatise. Why is wonder a vice? Wonder is a vice for Descartes because if you get caught up in wonder, you don't master anything. And you don't make any progress. So wonder for Descartes can be a momentary useful thing if it awakens you to something. But cultivating the habit of wonder, and he says at one point, I think, referring back to the passage in the Symposium of Socrates standing on the porch, stiff while everything's going on around him, that what happens to you in wonder is you're caught up still as a stone, unmoved, and unable to make progress on whatever problem is before you. So there are deep tensions between these different world views, and the Pope wants to say that what we need to do is to think of creation this way. Now, the other interesting thing is that this passage from the Commentary on the Physics from Aquinas that I mentioned is a passage in which Aquinas is developing, as he does there and in the two big summas, the analogy of God to creation. That relationship is analogous to the relationship of an artist to his or her artifact. So God in creation acts as an artist. Now, there are important disparities here, right? Because human artists, human makers of every sort, presuppose some matter that they then form. God presupposes nothing, creates ex nihilo. But one of the reasons that, so there are disanalogies here. Aquinas doesn't want us to think about God as somehow coextensive with the material world and then introducing forms into it. But one of the reasons he likes the analogy to an artist is it allows him to go between two equally problematic ways of thinking about divine creation. One is that everything that comes forth from God comes forth by a kind of necessary process. This was very much in the kind of Neoplatonic tradition that Aquinas inherits, where the first principle gives rise to a second and to a third, right? Out of a kind of necessity of nature. So this would make God not free in creating. But if you go over to freedom, the danger is this, and we are going over to freedom with Aquinas on God's act of creation, but the danger is that you start to think about what is created as arbitrary. So Aquinas thinks that the analogy to the artist doesn't have to create, right? The artist creates freely, but the artist doesn't create arbitrarily. The artist is attempting to communicate something beautiful in the making of an artifact. So this is an important feature for thinking rightly about creation. The second point that I want to make about thinking rightly about creation is what Francis says about the notion of a gift, and he comes back to this. Notice that the whole encyclical ends with a meditation on the Eucharist, right? Thanksgiving. Where God appears not from above, but from below in a tiny fragment of matter that is then offered back through the liturgy. The whole of creation is physically offered back in the Eucharist to God. This is receiving the gift and then offering it back to God. But gift is also a realm in which we have contingency, nothing. If a gift is necessary, it's not a gift. We have contingency, we have discontinuity between giver and receiver. It's also a realm, unlike contractual arrangements, gifts are realms of vulnerability and surprise. Okay? So that Francis goes on to quote Aquinas about how the artist can continue to work on his or her artifact even after the first making of it happens, right? So that God can continue to intervene. God can do new things in creation, right? God is continually active in creation, just as an artist can be with respect to his or her artifact. So if this is right, that what we need is a different understanding of the natural world through a proper understanding of creation, where God manifests, communicates beauty and wisdom to creatures in creation, and where we understand this as a gift that makes possible our very understanding and willing. So to go to back to that excessive anthropocentrism with which we began, this understanding of creation comes from nothing. We are not owed anything in creation because until it happens, God doesn't have to create. Right? We understand ourselves as part of a creation, and we understand even our willing as something that is gifted to us. So I mentioned at lunch today, my friend Russ Hittinger from Tulsa wrote a book about the natural law, which was kind of oddly titled, about 20 years ago now, The First Grace. It's the title of his book about natural law. That's because in the tradition of some of the church fathers, they spoke about nature as the first grace. Meaning what? The first gift. Right? What we call grace in contrast to nature, and it'll be coming up in this movie clip in a moment, is the second grace. So creation, nature itself, is a kind of gift, is a kind of grace. So if we have that understanding of creation, we'll develop a set of virtues that are increasingly absent in the modern world: awe, wonder, gratitude. We will also not understand ourselves in an excessively anthropocentric way, because everything that is around us is a gift that we have to use responsibly. So it's not lordship over nature, but stewardship that becomes the way of talking about our relation to nature. I also think that, and I'll turn to the clips here. We're doing on time right now. I also think that one of the things that Francis is engaging in here is similar to the strategy that John Paul II engages in Fides et Ratio. Right? What John Paul II is doing in Fides et Ratio is saying, you know, we started modernity with all this confidence about reason. And we get into the 20th century and nobody believes in reason anymore. Right? We're all skeptics, except for the technocrats. Everybody else, all the philosophers have moved into at least a moderate kind of skepticism about reason. And one of the things that John Paul II is doing, coming to the aid of reason as Pope, is to say that faith is a friend of reason. And the kind of polemical thing that's never stated, there is, the Pope is suggesting, maybe it's only in the context of faith that reason actually flourishes. Okay? That's the sort of polemical suggestion. I think Francis is doing something similar with the ecology. Francis is saying that, well, there are these people who say that our ecological problems, environmental disaster, is traceable to Christianity. Well, no, it isn't. Here's a really long encyclical to show you that that's not the source, and that we've got resources to come to respond to this contemporary crisis. Not only do we have resources, but maybe it's only with a certain set of virtues and a certain way of understanding nature that you can adequately respond to the roots of the environmental crisis. Or at least Francis is implicitly laying down the gauntlet to those who would have a completely secular account of the ecological crisis and of how to respond to it. He's implicitly saying, well, maybe, but let's see. Right? And maybe it's only in a rich theological account of how we understand creation that we can actually respond to the ecological crisis with confidence and hope. At least I read him as laying that down. Okay. Wonderful book by a Thomist from the Laval School, Charles Deconinck, wrote this in the first half of the 20th century called Cosmos, where he attempted to develop a real rich understanding of evolution in a Thomistic context, pretty rare at that time. Gilson was writing from Aristotle to Darwin and back again, much of which Deconinck would have agreed with, but Deconinck actually thinks that this account of creation as radically contingent actually fits with the evolutionary universe better than it fits with the old Aristotelian universe. And Deconinck ends this work, Cosmos, talks about how do we understand ourselves on this poor little planet born of a catastrophe? How do we understand our place on this poor little planet born of a catastrophe? He ends by saying, we will only understand ourselves when we understand the universe. Our present is filled with our past, our cosmic and evolutionary past. Right? That to understand ourselves properly is not just to have an account of reason, will, passion, body, soul. It's to actually have an account of where we are in the universe, what our part is in this whole that God has created. God didn't just create human beings on a planet. He placed that planet in this vast, complex, mysterious cosmos. In the film Tree of Life, I'm going to show two brief passages here. Go ahead and show the first one. Let's do that, and then I'll talk about it. Let me just show the beginning. I'm going on too long. Sorry about that.
It's restarted, so it'll take just...
Okay, let me give my comments, and then we'll watch this brief passage and then we can take questions. Sorry that I went on. This film is really interesting. One of the things that I wanted to connect up with the Deconinck statement is... at one point, the young boy in this film, which is set in the center of the universe in Waco, Texas, Terrence Malick film, but it has all this cosmological stuff in it, too. At one point, the boy says to his mother, and they're all sort of flashbacks coming to terms with the death of one of the brothers, says to his mother, tell us a story from before we can remember. And the proximate case of that is, tell me about when I was born, or tell me about when you and Dad got married. Right? But it's also, in Malick's hands, the story, the big story from before we can remember is the story of creation. Right? And so Malick includes this. That fits very nicely with what I take to be Deconinck's claim that our present is filled with our past, that we really need to understand ourselves as part of this vast, is it ready?
Yeah.
This vast cosmos. So go ahead, that's a good, I'll just play this beginning, this opening section here. Thank you.
Brother. Other. It was they who led me to your door. Follow.
please itself. Accepts being slighted, forgotten, disliked. Accepts insults and injuries.
So just a couple comments about this. The nature grace thing is interesting because it appears as a kind of dichotomy, and that gets broken down over the course of the film, especially when you even consider her last line there about nature is sort of turned in on itself when all the world is shining with love. Right? So that grace is actually coming from the natural world. And I think you can see that in the film. There are a couple of really interesting things about this film. One is that the opening sort of voiceover that you hear happens a lot in the film, and it's a kind of stream of consciousness. You're not even clear which character is speaking, but there are lots of films that have stream of consciousness in them. But I know of no films that include in that stream of consciousness prayer. So what Malick finds when he looks into the stream of consciousness of his character is individuals questioning God, individuals doubting God, individuals reaching out to God, asking for help. Very unusual. I don't know of any other film that does this. But I don't know about you. I'm not the most devout person in the world. But I do, during the day, find myself speaking to God in this way. And yet, I don't know of any other literary or film that does this, despite there's lots of stream of consciousness in lots of 20th century and 21st century. The other thing that points out is that these characters are not just talking with one another in a kind of linear way. They're also, the motion is often, of their speech, their questioning, is upward to God. And if you watch this film, and Malick does this in other films too, but it's especially pronounced in this one, you have a lot of camera action this way, but then you get these shots that go directly from the ground up through these Texas live oaks and reaching through the trees into the sky. It's as if Malick is saying that in order to understand dialogue, in order to understand our relations with others, we need to look not only before and after, but up and down. We need a perspective that breaks in from above and sheds light on the human situation. And then the other thing is the deep connection in the film between the personal and the cosmological. That if you go on to watch this, there's a lengthy creation sequence. This was the film that when it first came out in theaters, people got up and left. Like, what the heck is going on? Right? You got the story of these characters, and it's hard to figure out what's going on there. And then suddenly you got a 30-minute creation sequence. It's like, what? did Malick make two films and somebody spooled them together and didn't know what they were doing? But what Malick is really doing here is connecting the personal and the cosmological. And I think he's also making a kind of statement about the virtues of the artist, right? The virtue of the artist is not just to tell a story. The virtue of the artist who is attempting to do something really big and deep is to open up that perspective to the possibility of a dialogue not just between individuals, but dialogue between individuals and God. And that these questions about suffering and death have to be framed ultimately in light of that larger conversation. One of the things we did see at the very beginning is the quote from Job, right? Were you there when I laid the foundation of the universe? This discontinuity between us and God.
And if I were to play the other passage, there's a beautiful passage at the beginning of section four. The music is just fabulous. Preisner, the Polish composer, from his Requiem, this Lamentate. And as the mother asks at the end of section, end of chapter three in this film, where were you? The whole thing goes silent, and you see this creation scene, and you get this gorgeous Lamentate, right? That on that day of tears, as if God is saying through this music, I'm with you. I'm crying with you, right? In response to this human pain. But that's expressed, the entirety of the cosmos is expressed in terms of this liturgy. It's a kind of, to go back to Dionysius the Areopagite, a kind of cosmic liturgy that our liturgies are participants in. Let me stop there. I'm sorry I've gone too long. Thank you.